I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. U.S. Commerce Secretary Gary Locke is in Louisiana today, touring a shrimp processing plant and dining with fishermen in Metairie. Today is the first day of one of two commercial shrimping seasons in the Gulf, the first day of shrimping since the oil disaster, and officials are ramping up inspections and PR. The president swam in Gulf waters this past weekend, and press releases are touting stringent seafood inspections to find potential cancer-causing oil contaminants. But fishermen gathered in Biloxi last week are calling local catch voodoo seafood. Bill Thompson of Long Beach, Mississippi, told Reuters, "It's because we're all cursed," adding, "We do not think it's safe." Ewell Smith of the Louisiana Seafood Promotion and Marketing Board is with us. And Ewell, let's go to shrimp first. We know different kinds of seafood react differently to oil. Fish clear contamination out the fastest. Oysters and crabs are the slowest. So what about shrimp?
Shrimp's probably somewhere in the middle. And you know, we're working with EPA, FDA, NOAA. In our state, we have Department of Health and Hospitals and Wildlife and Fisheries. And bottom line is, any product that's going to get to marketplace will have been inspected and sampled and tested to make sure it's safe to go to the marketplace.
We should say the Associated Press is reporting that this is probably the most inspected fish ever, put under the microscope like no other kind. This is way beyond the sniff tests. In fact, we'll link you to a report. You see samples being brought in and ground down to look for microscopic pieces of oil. But we understand as well that there are shrimpers who are being quoted, like Dwayne Baham, a shrimper from Burris, worried that some fishermen will try to sell tainted shrimp.
Well, I don't think they're going to ever be able to get a product to market that's going to be tainted, because if it gets through oil, you're going to be able to smell it, see it, taste it. I mean, it's just not going to be a marketable product. That's the bottom line. The food source coming from the waters here is probably the most inspected food source there is in the entire United States.
In fact, maybe far more inspected than alternative seafood. We understand most seafood imported into the U.S. is not inspected.
The amount of inspection for imported seafood is very, very little. Our seafood coming from the Gulf right now is at extreme levels, unprecedented levels, and will be for quite some time to come.
What about dispersants? We understand the federal government doesn't have a test yet for these dispersants that broke up the oil, but they're developing a test. Aren't dispersants a threat?
As far as in the waters, we have not had any dispersants show up in the waters along our coast. EPA tests for that. And then if you talk to Don Kramer with the FDA, he'll explain to you in very simple terms, dispersants are 100%, the ones that have been used are 100% water soluble. A fish or a shrimp is a lipid-based animal, meaning it's an oily-based animal. There's no way for the dispersants to ever penetrate the tissue of the fish, so it's not going to get into the tissue. So the dispersants are not an issue for the seafood, which is really good news, and we were excited to get that news from the FDA a few weeks back.
Well, and as you said, Donald Kramer, who oversees the FDA's Gulf seafood testing, says the science says that we don't think there's a problem with dispersants. But we hear from other people. Susan Shaw of the Marine Environmental Research Institute up in Maine says, just make a comprehensive test. Why not? Just to know. But in the meantime, as you said, you've got the go-ahead. What does this mean to shrimpers there?
We turned the corner, because we've been going backwards for nearly 3 months. And now with the well killed, the waters opening and the shrimp season opening, we can start looking forward and building on a future now instead of looking backwards all the time. It took Alaska 5 years to rebuild their brand, and they spent $10 million a year for 10 years.
We understand that because prices dropped so much, there's concern on the part of the shrimpers that they're just going to not make that much for these first catches.
That's why we need the help from BP right away to get the marketing dollars. They put us in the situation. They need to help us get out of the situation.
Ewell Smith, Executive Director of the Louisiana Seafood Promotion and Marketing Board. And Ewell, can you just give me some numbers? How many shrimp fishermen are there in the region, and what's the revenue that comes in? What's the value of the industry?
The shrimp industry alone is a $1 billion industry to the state of Louisiana. Overall, our fisheries is about a $2.4 billion business, and we have just over 12,000 commercial fishermen. We go back 7 and 8 generations here in Louisiana, and it's more than just a fishery for us. It's the foundation for so many other things. You think about people who come to Louisiana to eat. Seafood is always the main ingredient on the plate when they come to a restaurant here in Louisiana.
Ewell Smith, thanks very much, and best to you today.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Well, attention Walmart workers. The world's largest retailer has partnered with the for-profit online American Public University, and as part of the deal, APU will offer Walmart employees academic credits for on-the-job learning. Now, those credits may be completely free, or there may be a small fee to take qualifying tests. This deal's still being worked out. And in order to land the contract, APU also made some concessions, like discounting tuition for Walmart employees who want to take actual APU courses. This isn't the first time a company has partnered with a learning institution to educate employees, but the Walmart APU deal is certainly the biggest of its kind. It's estimated about 700,000 Walmart employees do not have a college degree. And the deal comes as Congress puts online for-profits under a spotlight. The General Accounting Office recently accused several of the schools of fraudulent recruiting practices, misleading students about their post-education job marketability, and leaving them with huge debt. Now, American Public University was not cited in that investigation, but the so-called experiential learning aspect of the deal with Walmart has raised eyebrows. Should Walmart cashiers get credit for their on-the-job learning? On the other hand, why shouldn't they? Both online and brick-and-mortar schools offer credits for experiential learning, so let's take a closer look today, starting with the Walmart deal. Karen Powell is Senior Vice President and Academic Dean at American Public University. They're based in Charlestown, West Virginia. Karen, welcome.
Thank you.
And about 60% of higher ed institutions offer some form of this credit for work. It's called experiential learning, and we're going to hear more about it in a few minutes. But tell us, what's the thought about Walmart workers? What are some of the other exchanges that you're thinking about?
Well, Walmart has many different positions, and we've categorized them into 68 job categories, ranging from a store manager, a logistics manager, a loader, a cashier, a department manager, where we evaluate the training and the learning that has already occurred on the job for that category of workers. We compare their learning and the learning outcomes from that to our course objectives to see what kind of credit they might be eligible for, which is equivalent for college-level learning.
Well, for instance, what might a loader get?
A loader, they do a lot of work with transportation and logistics management, with supply chain management, and we would match their learning to the learning objectives that we have for our transportation and logistics management and related courses.
Well, now, as you know, for-profit online universities have a lot of supporters who say schools like yours help people who may be in rural areas, people who didn't have college opportunities, who can't get into the overbooked community colleges. On the other hand, as you're well aware, for-profits are also under scrutiny in Washington. They're accused of giving students educations that don't necessarily get them jobs, but burden them with tons of debt. So you know that there's already some scrutiny of for-profits. Are you worried that this will further erode an image?
We are aware of all of the scrutiny, very much aware. At the same time, we're also aware that the process that we've used is consistent with the standards established across higher education for awarding of credit. We serve a population that are full-time workers. I do think there's a misunderstanding when people say for-profit. I know for us, we're a university first. We happen to be exchanged on the NASDAQ by our owners and by the investors that invest in us, but more than anything, we are a university first.
Well, let's take a look at more of what is planned with Walmart students. The students get these automatic free credits if it's determined that their job experience and their performance in their job warrants the free credits. But if they want to take courses, who's covering that cost?
If they choose to continue studying with us and go and pursue courses, they are going to have to enroll and pay for their own education. We have agreed with Walmart to provide a 15% lifelong learning grant to Walmart associates. So in a sense, we're helping them to achieve their education.
Well, and Walmart says they're going to contribute $50 million over the next 3 years to subsidize some of this, but nobody's quite sure what's going to happen. Perhaps they'll help workers who can't afford it. But even with the grant that you've worked out with Walmart so that these students might pay less, online schools are more expensive in many cases than community colleges. So, again, what do you think you offer, especially given that these are students who may have a hard time affording even a grant tuition?
If a person would choose to go to a community college, we will support that. We have articulation agreements with many community colleges. Our goal is to encourage people to get their college education and to go back to school. If they want to come to us and work on their first 2 years of college, we welcome them. If they want to go to a community college and transfer later, we welcome that. We have an affordable tuition ourselves. We, you know, our standard tuition for undergraduate work is $250 per credit hour, which is higher than some community colleges, but is considerably lower than many of our for-profit sister schools, as well as the traditional schools in our sector.
You said something that raises another question that people have. Let's say that a cashier, because of her work done, does get credit for some kind of course. I mean, this is all being, you know, worked out, we know. Do you worry about whether or not credits will be transferable?
We always are concerned about transfer of credit. But even if you took courses with us, or if you took courses at another university at, say, you know, a state university and wanted to transfer it in, it is in the authority of the receiving institution what credit they will receive and from where. And that decision is made based on, you know, well, will they accept credit for experience? Is the credit transferring in applicable to the degree path that the individual is pursuing? So that's standard practice in every institution.
Well, we know that American Public University grew out of the American Military University. That was a correspondence-based school that then transitioned to the Internet in 1998, and APU. It was established in 2002, your school. You offer some 80 degree programs. Did you add any for Walmart?
We did not add any degrees for Walmart.
Yeah. So what are some of the ones that you offer?
The degrees that we offer, we have a bachelor's and associate's degree in management, and in management we have concentrations in retail management, human resources. We have a bachelor's degree in transportation and logistics management. We have degrees in English and humanities and history, in intelligence studies, in national security, in business administration. So we have the full breadth that a traditional university might have.
That's Karen Powell. She's Senior Vice President and Academic Dean of American Public University. This is the for-profit online school which has partnered with Walmart to be sort of the educator of choice for Walmart's 700,000 workers who don't yet have a college degree. And Karen, just, you know, by some estimates in the Chronicle of Higher Education and elsewhere, they say that APU, you, could be looking at 150,000 new students. And you might have to be looking at all of these, you know, jobs and hours worked and evaluating whether they've earned credits. You might be facing a lot of work suddenly.
I would say we're doing it in a very measured way over the next 18 months where we're evaluating the job codes. So we're not taking each of the 700,000 students and evaluating one for one. Mm-hmm. We're beginning to receive the interest from Walmart associates who are beginning to contact us. And it's a gradual implementation as we roll out these various job codes.
Karen Powell, again, of American Public University, thank you.
You're welcome.
And when we come back, a broader look at experiential learning, credit for job experience. That's in 1 minute, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
Welcome back. Before the break, we spoke with Karen Powell of the for-profit online American Public University, which is partnering with Walmart to be the school of choice for Walmart employees, including offering college credit to Walmart employees based on their on-the-job learning. That's called experiential learning, academic credit for real-life, non-classroom experience. It's not new, but the Walmart factor is raising some questions, including, will those credits be transferable to other schools? Pam Tate is president and CEO of the nonprofit Council for Adult and Experiential Learning, or CALE. They've been advising companies and schools for nearly 40 years on how best to utilize experiential learning. And Pam, you met with Karen Powell from APU. What was your reaction when you heard about this huge deal with Walmart?
Well, when I first read about it in the news, I was quite concerned because it sounded like APU was going to give credit for job experience, which is not at all what we would advocate. We would advocate for giving credit for college-level learning that was demonstrated on a job. But I then spoke to Karen, and they came out here with Walmart and tried to lay out their process in more detail. from what Karen said, it does not sound like they, in fact, are giving credit for jobs. They're giving credit for learning that they're assessing for job categories, and they're doing it based on competencies that match their courses. So on the face of it, it sounds as if they are doing what we suggest colleges do.
In other words, you don't get the credit just for the title of cashier. You get you get the credit, let's say, in a consumer relations class if it's demonstrated that while you're being a cashier, you do a lot of customer relations work.
Exactly. You get the credit for demonstrated knowledge and competence. And I've suggested some steps that they might take to make sure that they, in fact, are doing this in a way that meets our standards, especially, for example, having a second faculty member outside of APU review some of the very same areas so that they can have a kind of a quality check on what they're doing. Then they could validate that the process they're using is a solid one. And that's what I suggested to her.
What other recommendations did you make?
Well, actually, I suggested that one way they could do it is they could have some of their students come to Cale's own online prior learning assessment service, in which we will use faculty assessors from all across the country. And I suggested to APU that they consider using some of our faculty assessors as a second eye on their portfolios and competence assessment. And Karen responded really positively to all the different suggestions that I made.
Well, and so you know you're feeling a little more comfortable with what they're doing, but Karen Powell told us that it's unclear if these credits earned by Walmart employees will be transferable to other institutions. She said it's up to the receiving school, of course. So do you think future APU students should be concerned about this?
Well, there is, as she said, always a local institution decision here on any acceptance of credit. And colleges are more reluctant to accept credits from the for-profit colleges because they're worried that these will not meet their standards. So I do think that their students may face some uphill battles in getting their credits assessed. But honestly, the purpose of their agreement with Walmart is to matriculate and graduate students at APU. So my guess is that they will start and finish at APU rather than transferring to
right.
other schools.
Well, since we have you, let's talk more broadly about experiential learning. First of all, in general, what are some of the ways that it's used, I mean, outside of Walmart?
Well, you know, let's start at the community college level. For example, if a person was in a manufacturing facility and learned CAD-CAM design.
CAD-CAM?
Computer-aided design.
Ah.
So they might qualify for part of a degree in one of those, or welding, or other occupational specializations like that that are taught at community colleges. And if it was a bachelor's degree level, it might be that they worked in business. We've had employees that were bankers that had, 20, 25 years in banking but didn't have a bachelor's degree, and they could demonstrate knowledge in finance, business, accounting, and get credits toward a bachelor's of business administration. There are just huge numbers of different examples in all fields of people who have learned college-level material while working.
And by the way, do people pay for those credits? Is the savings in that they don't have to physically go to a class or take a class online?
Yeah, what they do generally is they pay for a course that prepares them to write up their learning in a portfolio. So they pay for the course, and then they pay for the credits they're claiming. They don't pay for the credits awarded. So let's say they think they have 20 credits, they pay for 20 to be assessed. And that's usually a third to a half as much as tuition.
Hmm.
So they save substantial money by getting the credits through assessment. Then they don't have to take the courses that they already have mastered and finish school more quickly and then have a better career path going forward.
And in any school, not just the for-profits or online, when you get these experiential credits, is it tough to transfer them?
You know, it's not as tough as it used to be because most colleges no longer indicate on the transcript that it was done through assessment. They just put it down as, Business 101 or whatever. They don't indicate that it was done through prior learning assessment. It's just treated as any other transfer credit.
Well, and one last question, Pam Tate. Do you think that schools do a good job in advertising the fact that they offer credits for life or job experience?
No, that's the problem, Robin. They have these programs on the books, and they don't tell anybody about them. And only a few schools really do a good job of outreach and marketing. And the rest of them, it's very hard for the student to even find out that this exists. The Council for Adult and Experiential Learning is starting our own online prior learning assessment service. And students will be able to get an estimation from us about the amount of credit that they might qualify for. We won't guarantee it, but give them an idea. And we're going to make this very highly visible as a national service because a lot of adults just don't know about it.
That's Pam Tate, President and CEO of the Council for Adult and Experiential Learning in Chicago. Pam, thanks so much for your time.
You're welcome.
Okay, quick look ahead. Tomorrow on Here and Now, do you think that everyone who serves in the military or everyone who sees combat is a hero? A retired Air Force officer says they are not, and to call them heroes is dangerous. We'll hear why tomorrow. Latest news is next, Here and Now. Here in Boston, investigators are trying to figure out how the high-profile prisoner accused of being the Craigslist killer apparently killed himself in his jail cell yesterday. 24-year-old Philip Markov was found with a plastic bag over his head and a laceration. He was the Boston University medical student charged with killing a masseuse he met through Craigslist. He was also implicated in two other cases involving women he met on Craigslist. He's suspected of robbing one and trying to rob the other. Maria Kramer of the Boston Globe has been following the story. And Maria, is there any suspicion that Philip Markov didn't kill himself?
At this point, no. There is no indication that there was foul play involved, and the Suffolk District Attorney's Office, which is investigating this, and jail authorities are calling it an apparent suicide. They have not said exactly what happened to him. They have not described the cause of death. However, sources that have spoken to me have told me that, as he said, he was found with a plastic bag tied over his head, and there was also a severed artery. He had managed to sever an artery. I don't know where on his body.
Well, and this has raised a lot of questions because there had been previous concerns that Philip Markov might kill himself.
Yes, that's correct. In April of 2009, shortly after he was arrested and arraigned for the murder of Jalissa Brisman and other crimes, he was found to have marks on his neck that suggested he had used shoelace strings to hurt himself. And at that point, jail officials put him on constant suicide watch.
Well, so now there are questions as to how he got the plastic bag. Meanwhile, we're reminded he was accused of killing 25-year-old Jalissa Brisman last year at the Marriott Copley here in Boston. Police say they hooked up on Craigslist, that he tried to rob her. She fought back. He shot her. How is her family reacting to his suicide?
Her family is devastated. They're in shock. And at this point, for them, I think that the trial was an opportunity to face him, to get some sort of justice for their daughter. And they won't have that. That's been taken away from them. If anything, it's a dismay to them. It's a disappointment because this was a chance for them to, you know, to see the person who prosecutors said was responsible for her death stand trial and be subject to a jury by his peers.
And maybe even find out more about what did actually happen that night.
Exactly.
Well, and we're also reminded, too, that Markov was arrested as he was driving with his fiancée. They were to have been married just about 1 year ago. Any reaction from his or her family?
We have heard nothing from his family or her family. Of course, we left many messages trying to obtain comment. But the families of both Megan McAllister, his fiance, and Philip Markov have been very quiet about this subject. They've never really wanted to say anything to the public regarding how the family's doing, except for a few brief comments. The attorney for Philip Markov said only that he was shocked and saddened by what happened, but he also kept his remarks to a minimum.
Well, but in the meantime, Leslie Walker, who directs Massachusetts Correctional Legal Services, has been speaking out, questioning how the case was handled. And she'd noted in the past that this year, the rate of suicide in Massachusetts jails is 8 times the national average. So this obviously is going to shed light on that statistic.
That's correct. I mean, while Nashua Street Jail does have a good record as far as prisoner safety, there have been 3 suicides at the jail in the last 10 years. And as you stated, Massachusetts jails right now are in prisons are under some searing spotlight for this startling statistic. But at this point, it's not clear exactly what kind of supervision Philip Markov was getting. We know that he was not under suicide watch. That has been told to us. But as far as how often they were checking on him, we do not know that yet.
Well, and this also cuts short that sort of macabre cultural path that these stories tend to tread along. You know, people were envisioning the trial and the attention that would be focused on this story and what it says about Craigslist, and it seems to have sort of just abruptly ended all of that.
That's right. This is a crime that really captured the nation's attention, international attention, not just because of the brutality of it, but also because of this seedy double life that police said Philip Markov was leading. And I think many people were looking forward to the trial to see exactly what more would be revealed about this man. I mean, it's a fascinating story about this person who seemingly had everything and threw it all away. And for Jalissa Brisman's family, it was an opportunity to see what would motivate the actions of somebody like this. Again, someone like Jalissa Brisman, a petite young woman who really had no chance when she came up against the man who killed her that night.
Maria Kramer of the Boston Globe, thank you.
Thank you.
When we come back, solar panels, wind-driven energy in a war zone? That's in 30 seconds here and now. One of the voices being raised in the push for alternative energy is the man who ran logistics for General David Petraeus in Iraq. Retired Brigadier General Steve Anderson is featured in this new ad from the group VoteVets.org.
Our troops are getting killed moving fuel we wouldn't need if our military was more efficient. And our enemies know that we're hooked on their oil.
General Anderson retired from the Army in 2009. Today, he's chief operating officer at Cinevision, a company run by former soldiers that helps clients with energy problems. And General Anderson joins us from the studios of WETA in Arlington, Virginia. Welcome.
Great to be here. Thank you very much, Robin.
Well, long before this was a business for you, it was a passion. Why? Tell us, what did you do in the war and what did you notice?
Well, I was running Iraq, the logistics operations in Iraq, and General Petraeus looked at me one day and said, "Hey, Steve, we're getting kids killed out there on the roads moving fuel. What can we do to fix that?" And so I initiated an action back in 2007 with technologists from all over the Army to come up with some solutions. And, of course, they came with a big plate of solar and wind and geothermal technologies, all of which were well and good, but would take tens of millions of dollars and years to develop. And so I said, what can we do quickly that can impact the energy that we're expending every day? The answer came back, we can insulate our structures. Presently, everything over in Iraq and Afghanistan is uninsulated, mostly tents. And my guys came to me and said, "Sir, we're air conditioning the desert." So that led me down to the road, found out about this technology, using closed cell spray polyurethane foam, something that's been around for 50 years, spraying it on the outside of tents. The Army recently studied it here and determined that the original $95 million contract is giving taxpayers $1 billion in annual cost avoidance. And more importantly, it's taken 10,000 trucks off the road.
Okay, let's take those one at a time. $95 million contract, that was for what?
That was to apply closed cell spray polyurethane foam on the exterior of tents, plywood structures, and trailers that are being used for housing and other activities in Iraq and Afghanistan.
And you say it's saving taxpayers $1 billion? How?
In Iraq, we buy fuel for perhaps $2.50. By the time the DESC, Defense Energy Supply Center, actually gets the fuel to Iraq, when you consider all the overhead that's involved, it's $13.80 per gallon. In Afghanistan, it's probably something twice that amount. And so you have to consider the fully burdened cost. What does it cost the government to get that fuel over there 8,000 miles away?
Well, and as you say, the biggest cost, the one that concerns you the most, is, as you say in the ad, more than 1,000 Americans have been killed in Iraq and Afghanistan hauling this fuel to these air-conditioned tents. Is that possible? 1,000 drivers of fuel have been killed?
The answer is probably even higher than that. Fuel trucks are huge, lucrative targets.
So you're saying cut down on the fuel by insulating the tents so you have less need for this air conditioning, as you said, air conditioning in the desert. But you're still going to need fuel. You're going to need fuel for the trucks. You're going to need fuel for the daily operations. You're still going to need fuel convoys, aren't you?
Absolutely. But only about, we figured about 80% of the fuel that we were using over there was going to provide fuel for the power generations that are providing electrical energy. We're spending about $20 billion every year air conditioning inefficient structures in Iraq and Afghanistan. A 20% improvement in that, that's $4 billion. That's more than the entire U.S. solar industry. Now, we all saw Secretary Gates' announcements looking for cost savings, $100 billion over the next 5 years. simply insulating structures in Iraq and Afghanistan might get him 20% of that objective.
You also point to the MRAP program that armored these vehicles that had no armor on them.
To me, that's a compelling example of how DOD policy can make good things happen and save American lives. Secretary Gates mobilized industry and the military to provide a solution to a huge problem. Americans were getting killed in poorly protected vehicles. So they developed these MRAPs, these mine-resistant, ambush-protected vehicles. Let's do the same thing for energy in Afghanistan. We can look at Afghanistan as an operational testbed for energy technologies. We can exploit those technologies and bring them back to the United States and help us beat the greatest threat to our nation, which is our over-reliance on foreign oil.
Well, this is interesting because you say that one of the reasons that we are in these conflicts, and I don't want to get the rumor mill going, it's not that you're saying that we went to war to get oil, but you're saying our need for oil underlines some of our conflicts.
Our need for oil is funding the enemies that are building bombs to kill us over there. You know, so everything that we can do to cut back on our over-reliance on foreign oil is a good thing. A great place to start is the military.
General Anderson, just a couple questions. This foam that gets sprayed, I mean, you obviously care about the environment. Does it have environmental side effects?
No, it's non-toxic. It's been tested by the Army, by the medical community, and by the Army test facility. They remove a lot of the particulates and the bacteria in the air. Soldiers often get respiratory illnesses over there. So there's all kinds of benefits. And again, we've been doing it for 3 years over there, so it's a proven winner.
How else do you see the Department of Defense maybe taking better advantage of alternative fuels, not just the foam insulation?
What I envision is small installations in isolated places like Afghanistan, where we're spending $400 a gallon to fly them fuel. Wouldn't it be wonderful to get them totally self-sufficient on energy in insulated, efficient structures and using photovoltaics and geothermals and wind turbines to provide all of their energy requirements?
How likely do you think that is?
I think it's very likely if DOD and Secretary Gates can mobilize the forces of industry and the military to make it happen. We did it with the MRAP program, but right now it's not a priority, and we don't have any comprehensive policy to take advantage of what is already a proven winner.
That's retired Brigadier General Steve Anderson, now Chief Operating Officer for Cinevision Solutions, former soldiers who are helping clients with energy problems. Also, while we have you, General, we just want to ask you, you were the head of logistics under General Petraeus in Iraq, and now we're talking about drawdown by the end of this month. As you watch, you know, from the sidelines, yes, but with your, you know, expertise, what do you see some of the challenges there?
Wouldn't it be nice to give to the Iraqis energy-efficient structures instead of dilapidated tents that are going to simply be thrown into landfills or burned or whatever? I mean, the State Department is going to be building installations.
You're saying as combat troops pour out, diplomats may be pouring in, and why not make their housing and the housing of the troops that remain energy-efficient?
Absolutely.
By the way, as we said, this has been a passion for you for a long time, since working in theater, but now you're with this company. What do you say to people who say you've got something invested in that, you know?
My company works almost exclusively in the commercial sector. I'm speaking out about this because I care about soldiers. I care about taxpayers. I am one. And I care about what our nation does with energy.
General, thanks.
Well, thank you very much, Robin.
Support for Here and Now comes in part from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org.
Welcome back. In the Middle East, one man's tragedy has both inspired a bid for peace and helped bring the magic of movies back to the West Bank Palestinian city of Jenin. The Bid for Peace, that's at the heart of an award-winning documentary about Ahmed Khatib, a 12-year-old Palestinian boy killed by Israeli soldiers as he played in the street in 2005. The film is called The Heart of Jenin. It focuses on the young boy's father, Ishmael, who lived with his son in Jenin, a known base for suicide bombers and fighters who attacked Israel at the height of the Second Intifada in 2000. In the hope of ending that cycle of violence, Ishmael decides to donate his son's organs for use in Israel. In this scene, an Israeli mother learns her child will live thanks to a kidney from the young Palestinian boy.
The doctor told me to come into the doctor's office.
She tells her that God gave me from
I couldn't believe it. God gave him a certain strength to do this.
But the story doesn't end there. After finishing the film, German director Markus Vedder and Ishmael, the father, had another idea, something that would benefit the city of Jenin itself. The BBC's Matt Haywood went to the West Bank to find out more.
Standing here today in this hot Middle Eastern afternoon, there's a real sense of excitement. Something building, something's about to happen, something positive. We're standing in the very heart of Jenin, just opposite the bus station and next to the souk market, and around me there's a crowd gathering on the streets with smiles on their faces, and a sense of anticipation is in the air. Because today is the day that the cinema of Jenin opens for the first time in 20 years.
2 weeks earlier, with the renovation work on the derelict cinema still underway, I visited Jenin to find out how this project had come about.
When I came the first time to Israel, our Israeli co-producer told us not to even think about entering to Jenin.
German documentary director Markus Vedder.
So I was quite scared to go here. And the first day it was clear that all this reputation about Jenin is wrong. I met very, very warm-hearted and welcoming people. After having made this film, Ismail recognized the power of documentaries and films. So we passed by the cinema. I knew that a lot of cinemas were closed. So it was an idea out of nothing that I wanted to support Ismail in renovating the cinema. So I went back to Germany, asked a lot of people, and they said, yes, we will support you.
So we're at the beginning of the 21st century. Now, cinema has been around for 100, 120 years. We've got the internet. These kids are all computer literate. Why a cinema?
Because cinema is something which breaks your heart, something you can touch, you can see. Cinema is for everyone. That was actually the main reason why I'm here. I did like 10 documentaries, most telling stories about people who suffer. And a documentary film can show that, can show injustice, can make people aware of things, can open their hearts, but almost never change really something at the place. Because it's hard to change, and you can't do it alone. So for all the other films where I couldn't give something back, I wanted to do it here.
So I come into the main auditorium. There's about 30 guys stood around. It's three stories high. The soundproofing is going in on the walls. The scaffolding crew is up. People working in the stalls, the second floor, putting the seating in. The stage is being built, and there's electricians running around putting the wires in, the speakers. It's busy.
Looking around me, the scale and ambition here is phenomenal. They've raised €1 million, but for that, they're building two cinemas, an indoor and 750-seat outdoor theatres. They've got two 35mm projectors and two state-of-the-art high-def digital 3D projectors, a restaurant and a children's play area. Entrance prices will also be affordable, just £1 or $1.20 a ticket. But they've also built a dubbing studio to translate films into Arabic. And they've got three editing suites where the local kids can learn about film and produce adverts for the evening shows. This place will cover everything from film producing to distribution, with the cinema sat right at the middle. Just a short walk round the corner from the cinema is the Kineo Centre for Peace Children's Centre, where Ismail, Ahmed's father and one of the co-founders of Cinema Jenin, has worked since his son's death.
Because Cinema Jenin is closed 20 years ago, a new generation. Between 16 and 20, not visit the cinema in the past because the intifada, and we have bad situation here. And now we want to teach him what means cinema. And the boys have now a place to go and to see a new things and maybe learn and teach many things, not sit in the street. I hope I see the children and the friend of Ahmed smiling.
Do you think that we can get some people who can train?
I've returned to the cinema and I'm just walking past the German volunteers who've come to build the place and train the local people who will operate the cinema. And I've come to meet Fakhri, Cinema Jenin's new manager.
The biggest donation we got is these people who are working now, and they can make the impossible mission. You know, since we started the project, a lot of foreigners are coming to see this town, which had a horrible situation before and a very bad reputation. It was considered as one of the most dangerous places on the earth. I want to achieve my dreams. I want something for my kids, for the future of my kids. In general, closing the cinemas in Palestine was like a sign that the war started. What we are thinking, opening the cinema now, means the war is end.
Back on the cinema's opening night, crowds, including the Palestinian Prime Minister, were in attendance before the screening of the film The Heart of Jenin. I caught up with Ahmed's father, Ismail Khatib. Ismail, you must be very proud. I saw you smiling in the theatre today.
I think it's fantastic what we're doing today. Everybody will see what we can do to Jenin. And I think Ahmed, he is alive. Now I see Ahmed in the people. It's fantastic what I feel.
Ismail, shukran and mabruk. Big congratulations. I've just spotted Fakhri Hamad, the manager of Cinema Jenin. You're looking very happy.
Yes, sure. I'm so excited. I'm so happy for that. Our cinema is open now. After 2.5 years of hard work, we are opening our cinema. I'm really so happy, so excited. I can't handle it. Thank you.
Okay. The capacity crowd has taken its seats in the outdoor theatre. There's a sense of excitement in the air. Above us, the stars are just beginning to come out. And any minute now, the moment that Jenin has been waiting 20 years for.
That report on the reopening of the cinema in Jenin in the West Bank was produced by the BBC's Matt Haywood.